And now, back to Stand Up with Pete Dominic on Indy. Sirius XM 104.
Aaron Carroll is joining us for the next hour. Sorry to truncate our very important conversation on race and bring it down 12 notches to healthcare and health policy. No disrespect, of course, to our expert guests, but these are obviously very, very important issues when it comes to health insurance and health policy and the Affordable Care Act. It's about to change a lot of the way that we get healthcare in America. But our next guest is really one of the best experts in the country on it, and we're always psyched to have him. He joins us almost every single Wednesday. And maybe I can get him to talk about race, but I don't want to get him in trouble. He's a professor of pediatrics and director of the Center for Health Policy and Professionalism Research at Indiana University. He's also the author of a couple books that talk and deal with medical myths and debunk a lot of what we might have been led to believe growing up, called Don't Swallow Your Gum, Myths, Half-Truths, and Outright Lies About Your Body and Your Health. And its sequel, Don't Cross Your Eyes, They'll Get Stuck That Way. And there's a new one that's coming out soon that we'll talk about. He also blogs at The Incidental Economist. Dr. Aaron Carroll, most importantly, he is on Twitter, and that's how we pay him to contribute to the program every week. We get him new Twitter followers. Forget to check what his current following is. I'll do that right now. At Aaron E. Carroll. At Aaron E. Carroll, 7669 right now, nice, according to this application. Hi.
How are you?
Sorry about that introduction. I apologize. Nice. And we're having this fascinating conversation about race, and I didn't want it to end, but, you know, that's what happens when you hit commercials in a new hour.
That's right.
You know, people stop listening anyway, so we can just start all over here.
Couldn't you get rid of the commercials?
Did we not? You said, could I?
Yeah, couldn't you get rid of the commercials?
Oh, I'd love to.
Plus, why are you so constrained to the hour format?
Well, we got to hit a top of the hour break. That's something that no one gets around. Why?
Yeah, well, I mean, you finally got rid of that blogcast, thank God. Why do we have to do a top of the hour broad thing?
Alfred, why do we have to do a top of the hour break?
Because they're part of a channel, and it's the mandate of the channel.
No, but every channel does that.
Not necessarily.
But they don't?
I mean, not necessarily.
Some don't. On channels like this, we use it to reset.
Good channels don't have to do that.
We use it to reset our format clocks so that our shows can replay properly in the future.
Oh, see, that's a good answer. Alfred should have given that answer.
My apologies.
Because okay. I said so?
Nope, that's not a good answer.
That's
either
what my mom would tell me.
Well, not a good answer.
No.
You know, the kind of like the biggest news story for you to weigh in on, you might not want to, and I know it frustrates you to have to, but it is really right up your alley about debunking myths, at least, which is this Jenny McCarthy.
Oh, yes.
So I know, and I'm going to go through your blog because there's a lot to talk about. And as always, we take a lot of calls with Dr.
Sure.
Carroll. So any questions you have about health insurance and health policy, the Affordable Care Act implementation, or anything else, 866-994-6343. Or if you just want to ask a question about penis length, which I may or may not have asked Dr. Carroll yesterday, by all means, at Aaron E. Carroll on Twitter, you can tweet him, but give us a call. But Jenny McCarthy, she has an autistic son, I believe.
Actually, see, that's okay, right there, that's a problem, but go on.
Why is that a problem?
Because actually, it may turn out that her son does not have autism, and that he has some kind of, disorder. I don't even know what the classification is, because I've never examined him. But I believe, unless I'm mistaken, that I read clearly recently that she thinks, well, it turns out he didn't really have autism.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I would, you know, it's one of those where I'd look it up. Maybe I'll try to type
autism. Is autism, like, how do you, I mean, like any other disease, how do you know it's autism when a child especially has, you know, is diagnosed as such? And there's also, I don't know much, but I know there's a spectrum as well in terms of functionality.
With some illnesses, it's not like there's a gold standard test. There's no blood test that comes back and says, oh, you've got autism, like, oh, you've got HIV, or oh, you have cancer. And so it requires sort of a pretty intensive battery of neurobehavioral tests done by qualified people who determine if you have certain behavioral characteristics which would place you on the autism spectrum. And, of course, then again, it's a spectrum, because people have different levels of functionality with having those symptoms or with having issues. So it's not as if it's sort of one thing and you just know you have it. So you're dependent on people to give you this test. Part of what makes it autism is that it is somewhat irreversible. It's not like it's a temporary condition which is going to go away. And the fact that her child had some issues or some kind of limitations that actually seem to go away with time, is one of the things you go, well, that's probably not autism. And I think she actually has said that he probably didn't have autism. Yep,
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'm looking at reports. This is from back from 2010. New report says Jenny McCarthy's son may not have had autism after all. And I pretty much remember, like, losing my mind about this because the fact that she's now going, oops, maybe he didn't have autism, and the fact that she's one of the people that truly led people to believe that that vaccines lead to autism is a huge issue. She back in 2010 says she talks about her son's progress, saying Evan couldn't talk, now he talks. Evan couldn't make eye contact, now he makes eye contact. Evan was antisocial, now he makes friends. And he's getting better, which is not autism. I mean, that is part of the problem, is that, these symptoms don't just go away if you have autism. If I remember correctly, too, I think her son had, a very long seizure, in which, for like 45 minutes or something, in which he probably had some kind of hypoxic hit, meaning that his brain perhaps wasn't getting all the oxygen that it should have, which would cause an injury which could lead to symptoms and deficits, which I think she claimed was autism, and those kinds of things are sometimes reversible. That's probably what happened. And so it's not even clear that her son had autism. And, of course, I don't want to spend too much time on her son because he's blameless, and there's no reason to sort of have everything focus on him. The bottom line is that she's not a scientist. She says a lot of things about vaccines and about autism that have no basis in fact or in science, and lots of people listen to them, and they have serious medical consequences.
Jenny McCarthy is the mother of her son. She claimed developed autism as a result of being vaccinated. She's been a vocal critic of childhood vaccines,
yep,
despite, of course, a lack of credible scientific evidence to support her view. Bill Nye, the science guy, who's a far more high-profile expert than you, Dr.
Thanks.
Carroll.
Although we were on the Dr. Oz show together once.
I hope he didn't even make eye contact, much less acknowledge your existence the way he should.
That is pretty much the case.
Oh, no! He was not nice?
We just really didn't interact. The Dr. Oz show is pretty scripted.
But backstage, I mean, you can...
There really was no chance for backstage with Bill Nye.
Dr. Aaron Carroll says Bill Nye is a mean prick here today on Stand Up.
I did not.
Dr. Carroll, tweet this out for me if you don't mind, Melanie. Dr. Aaron Carroll hates at Bill Nye or whatever the hell.
Oh, God, do not do that.
Okay, so Bill Nye makes a really, I think, I wonder what you think of this point. I mean, basically he's saying Jenny McCarthy's errant views on childhood vaccines may be discredited on The View. Does the idea perhaps that Jenny McCarthy has gotten this high-profile job on The View, I think it's a good thing because it brings up this debate.
Right there. The fact that you say debate is what this is. How do you feel about climate change?
Okay.
It brings up
the misinformation that she has spread, so that anybody who might believe it is going to be inundated with a whole bunch of sources that are going to debunk this very, very dangerous belief for her kids and others.
And if I believed in my heart that that's how it was going to be done, but I think it'll be the debate, which is how you just, by accident, because that's just how everybody refers to it, and which will give credence to this, the idea that there's two sides to this.
Right.
That there's two credible, thoughtful sides, and one group is just asking questions. That's not the case. It is absolutely discredited to the point where the original research, which was done by Andrew Wakefield in London or in Britain and published in The Lancet, has been discredited not just as scientifically inaccurate, but likely as a fraud, in that they falsified the results to make it look like the vaccines caused, the vaccines were linked to autism, never caused autism, because again, this is never a randomized controlled trial, but it was an incredibly weak study. It was really just a case report, and it looks like almost all of the data was fraud. They made it up to make it look worse. So entirely discredited. There's no scientific case for this. All of the subsequent studies show no link. The only study that sort of existed was a tiny case series of made-up stuff. So there's no debate. There's no credible scientific community.
Okay, Paul in Florida, you're on with Aaron Carroll.
Oh, here we go.
Hey, boss.
Hey, boss, man.
Hey, doctor. Thanks for taking my call. Look, I recognize Jimmy and those guys are nuts, but I can almost understand why they feel this way, because it seems like every time you turn around, the autism figures are increasing. You know, 1 in 1,000, 1 in 500. Oh no, it was 1 in 3.
Right.
And I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. No, okay.
Seems like autism is getting worse and worse. Yeah.
I would agree with you. Yes, I completely agree that that is what the perception is going on. I was just going ahead. Go ahead.
Right, and it almost seems that it's not like this, but I mean, it almost seems like having a child with autism is the new trendy thing for a mom to do. And I'm wondering what is driving this autism research and diagnosis. Is this Big Pharma pushing this research, or is it parent organization?
No, I would actually say this is not. So you bring up, I think, an excellent point in that, you know, lots of people are worried about autism because it seems to be so much more prevalent, and because, let's be totally honest, it's a real problem. Kids that have it have significant issues. They have, you know, we want to get them into services. And so doing research in autism, I completely support. Look, I participate. I'm on grants that do research to try to diagnose and detect kids earlier with autism, to try to figure out how we can get them into services and do a better job. I completely support that. My problem is that people have latched on to vaccines, and they've said, well, you know, kids are getting more vaccines, that's when the kids are getting more autism, that must be the cause. But, you know, that would be like saying cell phones are causing autism, because more and more people are using cell phones, and therefore more and more people are getting autism, so cell phones cause autism. Or, you know, Game of Thrones causes autism, because more and more people are watching Game of Thrones, and there's more and more autism, so what they're... No, it's...
That's been proven, actually. That's actually been proven.
So what is driving the increase in autism? It's probably multifactorial. One is that we do a much better job at detecting it. There's much more awareness about it. People are much more on top of it. And so it is very likely that lots of people are much more likely to look for it, which means they're much more likely to find it. Secondly, we have broadened the basis of the diagnosis. So, you know, before what we might have called Asperger's syndrome, or what we might have called even just, you know, functional deficit, now is an autism spectrum disorder. So the numbers are inflated by that. Third,
okay, I appreciate it. We'll talk to you later.
Okay, so third,
he's done. He's convinced.
Oh, all right. Well, I was going to give it.
But go ahead.
I was going to say third. You know, it's important to know that because autism is such a political hot button issue, it is often easier to get kids with deficit services if you give them the diagnosis of autism. Money is often set aside in line items and budgets to say we're specifically giving money to autism. And so, if you have a child who needs services and you give them a label of autism, even if they happen to be really at the edge of the spectrum, they're going to get services. So we're doing it more because that's sometimes what doctors and everybody does in order to get kids the services they need. So
that's really
that has also increased the diagnosis. And it may be that it is more common, but that's a part of it, not the entirety of it. And we want to figure out why. We don't totally know why. But what's clear is it's not the vaccine.
Here's what we're going to do. I want to just actually clip out and maybe continue this. But that long piece on Jenny McCarthy and autism and the answers Dr. Carroll gave to the caller, Paul, and I want everybody to be able to share that with their non-listener, non-SiriusXM subscriber friends, because that was very thorough, as usual. Dr. Carroll, Keith in New York, you're on Stand Up.
Hi. And, you know, I just got to mention, there is an outbreak going on right now of measles, the most inoculated, you know, thing to get rid of. There's children, there are infants in Brooklyn. This is not, you know, some third world disease. Measles killing infants. It has caused myths in pregnant women. It is killing children. People talk about this as if, you know, well, what if the dangers of getting autism? There are real dangers of getting measles. My wife had whooping cough when she was in utero in her mother. It has had long-term effects of her immunology and how she, you know, combats disease and colds and flus going forward. These are very real problems. We look at this problem, and I hear people like Jenny McCarthy, and I agree with Dr. Carroll. This is a horrible idea. We look at people like Jenny McCarthy and say, well, we need to judge, you know, the risk of the vaccine. No, you need to judge the risk of getting measles. You need to judge the risk of getting whooping cough. You need to judge the risk of getting any of the number of diseases.
Well, now The View, the program, is now being sponsored by measles, mumps, and rubella. And also another John Lovett tweet. He says this quote, is attributed to, let's see, congrats to Jenny McCarthy on The View. We're proud to have one of our best allies in such a prominent position. And that quote is attributed to communicable disease.
Big polio has really been pushing for her for a long time.
The big polio lobby. How dangerous. So, but here's what it says on the screen that you were going to. It says children will die because Jenny McCarthy doesn't believe in vaccines.
I think these beliefs have been the cause.
And I am not being hyperbolic here. I really honestly believe that children not only have died, are dying, and will die because people listen to the.
Is that too far? Is that too far with the caller, Keith?
I actually think a number greater than zero of children have died because people have bought into this myth.
Wow.
I think, you know, there have been people, not just in this country, but in England, when this all hit, everybody stopped vaccinating. There have been measles outbreaks. There have been pertussis outbreaks. Children have died. The children who are not vaccinated are at significant, and this is done, you know, we can study them after the outbreaks. Children who are not vaccinated are at significantly increased risk over the children who were vaccinated, even though the vaccinated children are 100%, the ones who aren't vaccinated get sick at much higher rates. They allow the infection to take root. They allow us, you know, the herd immunity to be overcome, and more children die who were not vaccinated than who were vaccinated. So
I think that the number is greater than zero. On herd immunity, because the fact of the matter is vaccines are not 100% effective. Even if you get the vaccine, you still have a chance of contracting the disease, and what prevents that from happening is if you have a room full of people and everyone gets the vaccine, let's say 80% of them it will be effective on, what prevents it from getting to that one guy in the front that's not going to have a vaccine that's effective for him is all the people in the back that do not carry that disease.
Well, and then
that's what herd immunity is doing.
You also have to remember that there's a significant number of people in the United or in the world who can't be vaccinated. Babies can't be vaccinated or you know, they can't be vaccinated. The elderly are sometimes immunocompromised. So you often don't just get vaccinated to protect yourself. You get vaccinated to protect your brothers and sisters. You get vaccinated to protect your grandparents. You get vaccinated to protect the unfortunate child who lives next door who has cancer. For instance, we only vaccinate against varicella or chickenpox at age one and above, but the number of babies, I think it was in New York they did a study, who got varicella dropped to almost zero. Because by vaccinating kids over the age of one, we removed sort of the ability for them to infect babies. So even though we couldn't infect the babies yet, they were protected by the fact that we started vaccinating everybody else, and the number of deaths due to varicella dropped to literally zero. And so it's not even just that we do it because you want to protect your own child, because, again, the likelihood of you individually getting the disease is small. It's real, but it is small. But we're doing it because it's a societal good. It's how we eradicate these diseases entirely. It's how we protect unfortunate people who are otherwise sick, who have HIV, who have cancer, who are immunosuppressed, who are babies, who are old. This is how we do it. And we're using a myth, which has been absolutely disproven by huge research, to continue to let this go on, where people are getting infected and people will die. And I'm sorry, but like, she's completely associated with this belief. She's absolutely tied into it. I've probably written books, even though I haven't read them, but I'm sure she has. And to sort of give her a platform, even to like give her so that we can have a quote unquote debate about this, is, I think it's harmful. And I'm disappointed that they went this route.
Has she walked any of what she has said in the past back on this? Does she change any of what she believes? I mean, if this all comes from one study and one guy and it was considered fraud, I mean, you know, the climate change skeptics have all kinds of theories that they try to, in studies.
They have things that they'll point to as quote unquote research. But it'll be somebody that says, but it'll be anecdote. It won't be like, it will not be well-designed, controlled, peer-reviewed studies. It'll be, well, did you, and what they also do is they ask questions. I'm just asking questions. Why can't you do a study where we see if this group is going to be more susceptible or that group? Well, we can't do those studies because they're unethical, because we know vaccines work. So not to vaccinate children in order to do future research would be horrific. It would be like saying, it would be as if we gave it to the tobacco lobby and said, we're going to start doing randomized controlled trials of smoking so we can prove that it causes lung cancer, which has never been done. No one would allow us to do that. But it allows the tobacco companies to keep saying forever, well, you never proved it. Why won't you do the research? There's conflicting evidence. Studies don't know. It's the same exact argument of well, why won't you do these? We can't. That's not ethical. It'd be wrong. We'd be knowingly subjecting children to risk and potential death just to discredit an already discredited argument. So they ask questions. They point to gaps in research. They point to children, and they wheel out parents who are very convincing, who also deserve nothing but sympathy, who said, my child seemed normal to me, and then about the age of one, he got vaccines, and then I noticed something was wrong. And it's just an association. It's just that we vaccinate children at 3 months, 2 months, 4 months, 6 months, 1 year, 15 months. So you're vaccinating them so often, anytime you notice something, it's going to be around the time a child got a vaccine. And that happens to be an age when parents first start noting that perhaps the child's behavior is different. It also happens to be a time these days when parents are hypervigilant because they have heard vaccines cause autism. So they get a vaccine, they watch really carefully, they notice for the first time some problem with their child's behavior, they believe it never happened before, they blame it on the vaccine. But huge studies, tons, this was the final chapter of our first book, which break down every single possible argument. Studies of millions of children who've gotten vaccines, and they can find all kinds of links between vaccines and small side effects, but none with autism, none.
All right. We're talking to Dr. Aaron Carroll, who will always be happy to take your phone calls on all things about the Affordable Care Act, about health policy, health insurance. As you can see, he's pretty well versed in all these issues and obviously great at articulating them right off the top of his head. We've already got a couple calls, and you've been writing a lot of great blog entries about, some good news, childhood obesity decreases that might be real and other things. But I want to get to them. But let me get to the people that have been calling and you're, of course, at their service, providing this amazing public service for us on Wednesdays in the third hour. And I hope people pay you back by giving you a follow on Twitter at Aaron E. Carroll. That's his name. Matt in Staten Island. Hey, my friend.
How you doing, buddy?
Good. Go ahead.
Dr. Carroll, I had a question for you. I'm a member of Bricklayers Local 1 in New York City. We are 3,500 members, and we have about 3,000 retirees. We have Blue Cross Blue Shield as our hospital coverage. Our premium is going to go up next year from $8 million to about $12
million. Mm-hmm.
Now, I was curious, with all the exchanges, the Affordable Care Act, I know it was postponed, but we're trying to figure out, why is it going up so much in 1 year? I mean, you're talking about basically, going up almost like, 40%.
Yeah. Each individual rate increase like that has to be reviewed, so I couldn't give an exact answer, but, has it gone up in the past few years?
Yes, but nothing. It's gone up nominally.
Right. This might be a catch-up period. It just might be that, they're just catching up to what they think it is. I'm going to guess, if you're a union, that you guys have probably negotiated for pretty robust coverage, which, don't get me wrong, completely support. I think it's great. But that kind of coverage is expensive, and it's going to keep going up. There's nothing in the law which is going to sort of, hit that kind of private coverage and try, when we talk about restraining the cost of health care, when we talk about things which can bring down health care spending, they're all focused on Medicare and Medicaid. They're all focused on government spending. And we hope that trickles down eventually to the private market. But none of the changes that have been made, accountable care organizations, bundled payments, different kinds, none of that's private insurance. So there are no sort of real huge restraints yet on the cost increases of private insurance. It's really likely they're going to continue to go up. Yours is not, people will blame the Affordable Care Act and say, oh, it's the mandate, oh, it's raising the level, they won't, they're demanding we pay for all these things we didn't used to. None of that will impact your insurance, which was probably already more than qualified.
Matt, thanks. Sorry, I didn't get a follow up. I love you. Bill, Pennsylvania, you're on with Dr. Aaron Carroll. He is at your service at Aaron E. Carroll on Twitter. Go ahead, Bill.
Yes, hi, Pete. And I do follow Aaron on Twitter.
Excellent.
My question was, I work for a delivery company, large delivery company, and we have a great benefit package, which, I'm happy to have that I don't have to pay for.
Mm-hmm.
But I was under the understanding that I may be taxed on that as income. Is that true, and how would they base that? Because that would be a huge tax burden from what I already paid.
Okay, no, that's not true. So let's back up and take a deep breath to begin with. There have been proposals in the past to remove the tax insurance the health insurance tax deduction. In fact, that John McCain proposed that. Now, I don't want to bash him because he proposed fixing it with the tax credit, but there have been proposals to do that. None of them are up for voting. None of them are going to pass. So that's not true. The only tax that could kick in eventually for something like what you're talking about is the excise tax. In other words, if your insurance is unbelievably robust and super expensive, then at some point in the future, something like 2017, your insurance company or your employer will have to start paying a tax on insurance above a certain amount. So do you have a family plan or a single person plan?
Well, I'm a single person right now because
Do you have any idea how much your insurance benefit is? Like how much they're paying for it?
It is out there, but I don't know personally. I don't follow it.
Less than $10,000?
$20,000. Yeah, somebody said it was over $20,000 a year.
For an individual? Okay, if you're over $20,000 for an individual, you have one of the most expensive insurance plans in the United States. Because the average plan for an individual...
I don't know what it would be offhand. I mean, it's very good insurance. I mean, it's through the Teamsters and stuff like that. You know, you'll pay for anything, not even...
But I mean, like, the average employer-based health plan in the United States is like $4,800, maybe $5,000. So $20,000 is way expensive. And what makes it sort of silly is that you could get a ridiculously good plan for far cheaper than that. So probably what your business at some point in the future will do is say, the excise tax is coming down the road. This is years away. The excise tax is coming down the road. We're going to wind up facing the tax bill if we continue to offer this plan for $20,000. We'll find a plan that costs $10,000, which, you got to believe me, is still ridiculously good insurance, and they'll get below the cap to avoid the tax. But there's nothing that's going to start next year taxing you working for a delivery company that's going to kick in. That's going to be some huge tax on your health insurance. That is not part of the law. It is not going to happen.
All okay, right. Well, I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much, Bill. Michelle is in Florida, and I don't know if she's following Dr. Carroll on Twitter or not. Are you on Twitter? Are you following Dr. Carroll at Aaron E. Carroll, or else we can't take your call?
I think I am, honestly. I haven't checked my Twitter in a while, so I'll have to plead the fifth on that one.
If you get a good answer, will you agree to check on it? And if not, create a Twitter account just to follow at Aaron E. Carroll.
Oh, I do have a Twitter account, and I'm following you, Pete, but honestly, I don't know if I've followed Aaron.
All right, well, you will promise to check on and confirm.
Regardless of the answer.
Okay.
So the question I have for Dr. Carroll is, I heard you mention earlier that the argument against doing a study of vaccinated versus unvaccinated children would be that it would be unethical.
Yeah.
My question for you is, there are hundreds of thousands of families in the United States right now who have not vaccinated their children, who refuse to vaccinate their children because of the risks and the fears that they have, because, frankly, they don't trust the CDC. They don't trust Big Pharma. So my question is, why can't we use these children in that study?
Well, they do studies. They have done studies like that, but you have to always remember that those studies are always confounded. For instance, there are religious or ethnic groups that refuse to vaccinate their children. Those religious and ethnic groups often have diseases that run in them. You know, Ashkenazic Jews have certain diseases that run in them. The Amish have certain diseases that run in them. So whenever you do a study where you let people select for one reason or another into certain groups, they cluster, and we have problems. Another problem is with autism. Autism is one of those weird diseases where it seems to run more positively in higher socioeconomic status groups. Those are also the groups most likely to deny vaccines. So, you know, people will argue, well, we won't get the vaccine. People who support this kind of research immediately argue that that kind of study won't work because they recognize that autism is going to show up more preferentially in some of the groups which are already self-selecting to not vaccinate. And they think that that will therefore, you know, kill the argument that they will say, well, you know, we can look and say, look, autism is more prevalent in the people that don't get vaccinated than in the people that don't. And I, as a researcher, because I'm trying to be honest, will say, yes, that's a biased study. That's not giving us truth. But that's why trying to do the natural experiment is a problem. Having said all of this, those studies have been done. That's what's been done. In other words, when they
I've never heard of a study. If you've got information on a study,
buy my book. This is one of the few times I'll just tell you, buy the book, or even go into a library and read the last chapter. In fact, I take it back. I bet I have reproduced online the entire last chapter on the blog. Go read the blog, because we've detailed these huge. I mean, they do studies like in countries, because other countries collect medical data far better than we do, like Denmark, where they track who gets vaccinated and who doesn't, and whether or not this is how they do it, and they can look at it, and if there's no association.
Would you agree, though, that the current vaccine schedule is overdone? I mean, to give an infant 1 day old a hepatitis B vaccine when neither of their parents are positive for a Hep B.
Right.
Why? Why put the child through that risk? I mean,
here's the thing.
Like 60-something in the developed countries of infant mortality.
You have to.
There is a problem.
We've got to back up.
It's not being addressed by our government.
Do you vaccinate your children? Did you vaccinate your children, Michelle?
I vaccinated my son until he was age 2, and at that point I learned better and I stopped.
Okay. The number of vaccines that are given out seem to be much larger than they used to. But there's two things you have to realize. It is not the number of shots that determines what your body is doing. It's what's actually in the shots that determines what your body is doing.
Oh, absolutely. And you're giving kids four or six vaccines in a day.
You got to let me answer. The number of proteins that was in the original shots, because they weren't perfected or unrefined, was in the order of thousands. So they were responding every time we gave them to a shot to, like, thousands of antigens that they had, that the body had to respond to. Today, if you add up all of the shots and what's in them, the number is an incredibly tiny fraction of what we used to give children. In other words, although we're giving them more shots, the number of proteins or antigens that we're asking the body to respond to has gone down by a tremendous amount. So that actually the response burden of what the body has to deal with as an infant through the shots is way less than it used to be. So it's not the number of shots, which people point to, it's what's in the shots. And what's in the shots has only gotten less and less and easier over time. So today's many, many, many shot vaccine burden is significantly less than the few shots we used to give out a decade or two decades ago. Moreover,
okay, you're talking about antigens, but what about those things that are in the shots that are not the antigens?
Proteins.
What about the propylene glycol? What about the formaldehyde?
That's what I mean. We've purified them. We've gotten them to be simpler. So the number of things in the shot that they have, that the body will respond to, is significantly less than it used to be. Even the things people have problems with, the thimerosal, gone. There's been no thimerosal in children vaccines since 2003. So we keep making them safer and less and less, but everybody focuses on the number because that's what they're concerned about. And you have to get past all that. The number of antigens that an infant is exposed to by being in the world is a gazillion times higher than what's in the shot. Every day the body is responding to tons of particles and dirt and germs and bugs and things that we don't even appreciate because they're everywhere. And the body is built to respond to all of those things. The number that we're adding to that with a shot is absolutely inconsequential.
Well,
where do you get all your passion and your expertise? You clearly know what you're talking about. Are you a healthcare professional, Michelle?
No, I'm not.
Okay, so you've done some research.
Burnout.
All right, and you have not gotten your child vaccinated since age two?
Since age two. You can't unring the bell. You can't unvaccinate. And my concern is that there has not been enough to address not just the autism question, which I understand you believe
What study would you need to be done with how many children before you would feel comfortable giving a vaccine? And if the answer is none, that's perfectly acceptable. But to say that there's not enough research, you got to quantify for me what it would take, because the number of studies that have been done to prove vaccines are safe are greater than any other drug that's out there right now, probably.
The number of people involved is massive.
So I haven't done my research.
I have not seen that study that shows me vaccinated versus unvaccinated.
At some point, for me, I don't do the research. I don't do the research myself. I tell everybody to think for themselves and look it up all the time. But at the same time, I do as much as I can with the amount of time that I have to be, in this case, a responsible parent. But at some point, you have to trust people who have, you have to trust people. You have to trust actual people and organizations. If you're never able to trust people and organizations and you're only able to trust yourself, I mean, one of the things that's interesting about this, and I've learned so much from talking to Dr. Carroll, becoming personal friends with him, and actually being in his office and looking at his computer screens, is that you actually need a degree just to know how to do proper research. You actually need to know how to do research on research. If you don't know how to do research on research, then you're probably going to come away with a lot of errors on this scientific issue and many others. It's very important to know how to look at what you're looking at. So my question back to you, Michelle, is, do you trust anyone? Do you trust any expert or group of experts or organization or peer-reviewed study on anything?
And I would go like,
who funds them?
Okay.
It depends on who funds them.
There's no, I promise you, that like almost all of the studies we're talking about have been funded by governments and countries because they're not, there's no money to be made really in vaccines. Vaccines are like.
Oh, there is tons of money to be made in vaccines.
Vaccines are like, we have trouble getting companies often to make the vaccines because it's not something you take every day for the rest of your life, which is how you make a gazillion dollars.
But you're wrong, Michelle. You're wrong. You are. And that's really dangerous to be.
But I go further. I have now told you the studies have been done. I have told you where you can see the studies. I've told you where you can read about them.
And I will absolutely read them.
But if you still come away and say, I don't believe it, or I need more research to be done, that you can't be just that I have questions.
But that's not, she's not reachable. She's not reachable. Okay. She has made up her mind.
You're making an assumption, Pete, now. I am. You're telling me that I'm not reachable.
I'm telling you that I appreciate that you'll read it. I appreciate that, but I'm telling you, you'll read all day. You strike me as a person who will read all the research on an issue and do due diligence, and you have good intentions. I'm not saying you don't. I'm saying you're not reachable because you won't listen. You won't listen to Dr. Carroll's point about why vaccines don't make a lot of money. He didn't get to finish that point. I'm very curious to hear him finish. Dr. Carroll, please finish the point about vaccines and the amount of money that they can make.
You can make a ton of money on things that have to be given often. If you make a drug for like controlling acid reflux, people take it, you know, every day for the rest of their lives, tons of money to be made. If you make a Viagra, men will take it often for the rest of their lives, tons of money to be made. A vaccine is given X number of times and never again. And so you exactly know the fixed number of, I can predict this year how many doses of vaccine will be given, period. And that is it. There's no extra profit to be made. We can't make commercials to get people to take extra. And in fact, they keep trying to find ways to bundle them together so that there's even less. So it's literally, you know, right off
but
the bat.
They keep finding additional things. Oh, well, you know what? We need to give this HPV vaccine.
Yeah, but you don't. You can't.
Not only our girls, but we need to give it to our boys.
And then you're done. And then you're done. You can try to make it, but once you've given it to all the girls and all the boys, it's over. That is literally it until the next year when another group comes along. There's never like, oh, we need to give people 12 more doses. No, it's just once you've maximized and given it to everybody in the human race once or however many times you need it, it's over. And you cannot, as a pharmaceutical company, make $1 billion or a super drug like you can with the Viagra or a Pepcid or a Nexium. Those can be given out a gazillion times for the rest of your life.
Well, because people, to cut through what both of you are saying is because those drugs are something that someone takes every day or once a week. For a long, long time, and they have to keep getting that prescription refilled. You don't have to keep getting a vaccine.
Certainly they are making a lot more money on those types of drugs.
But to do all the research, I can't believe you're making me take the side of pharma here, because it's just unbelievable. But let's be honest, if I'm going to create a new drug today, and I'm a pharmaceutical company, and I'm going to invest my money, I can either choose to go to a vaccine where I can predict right now the maximum money I can make, period, because once I've vaccinated everybody, it's over until the next year. Or I can create a new drug, which is just a slightly Me Too drug, that will treat a non-curable entity where people will take it to slightly improve their quality of life multiple times a day for the rest of their lives. Where am I as a company going to invest my money? I'm going to invest it in the latter. So getting companies to develop and create vaccines, which is what I said, is very hard because there's not as much money to be made. I'm not saying they
don't. Michelle, I appreciate the call and the discussion. I really do appreciate the passion and the amount of research that someone like Michelle does. She's misguided and she's wrong, but she has good intentions. So I'm not insulting her in any way. She's just wrong. And Dr. Carroll gave us a lot of evidence and enough to go with. And you can decide and think for yourself. I've got to take a break. Last word from you. I got to take a break.
I just want to say, I have no. If you say you haven't seen the research, I have now told you where it is. I've now told you what it is. If you go and read it and you come away with, I need more, you must quantify for me what the study would be that would convince you and how many people need to be in it. Because we've already done studies that cost billions of dollars and millions of people. And if you tell me that you need another one, you got to tell me what it is that's not been done before. And if you can't, then just own that you're not going to be persuaded by evidence. I have no, you know, I can live with that. We'll stop having the argument. But you can't just say more research. You got to tell me what we're lacking.
All right. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back with and talk with Dr. Carroll about some of the other things on the Incidental Economist, which is, by the way, where he blogs. At Aaron E. Carroll, if you want to contribute to this or any discussion, you should be following him on Twitter. We will be right back with more with the good doctor.
Stand up with Pete Dominic. You're listening to a radio bumper for a show. Now some music, then talking.
This tweet from T.B. Lofgren. Hey, at Pete Dominic, I just read at Aaron E. Carroll's bio on the Incidental Economist. No mention of stand-up in his appearances. Hashtag WTF. I mean, I'll go and look and think for myself, but maybe it's not relevant. Maybe it's not.
Do a search of stand-up on the blog, and it will show up only like a billion times.
Let's just see. His work has been featured in the New York Times, USA Today, Los Angeles Times, Newsweek, and many national publications. He's appeared on Good Morning America, CBS News, ABC News Now, and The Colbert Report.
You know, I bet that still says associate professor, which tells you how often I edit it.
Okay, but I mean, is it too much to ask for? You can hear him regularly on stand-up.
I'm saying I have not edited that forever.
I know. I'm asking you. Bios need to be short. You don't want too much in a bio. Is it too much? Not as a friend. Is it too much to ask for that line?
No, not at all. Not at all.
Are you going to do it?
Yeah, but it won't be like while I'm on the air, but yes, I will absolutely do it because I know I have to go and edit it anyway just for other stuff that's out of date.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, we appreciate it.
Yes.
There's a new study out about baldness and its relation to heart disease, which gives me a lot of concern. Are you familiar with this?
Rob, see, this is your problem. It's not a new study.
Oh. So I just read the headline, and so now I've decided I'm going to die.
When was that article published?
I don't know. I just saw it.
When was the article you just read? Was it like in yesterday's newspaper or something?
Yes, I saw it today. I just saw the link today.
No, the study, I believe, was published in April when most credible news organizations covered it. And even then, it was a meta-analysis of previous research, which was already known from years ago. There's an association. So I think it's like
baldness linked to coronary heart disease, according to study.
Yes, it is. It's like a relative risk, if I remember correctly, of like 1.3 if you have, if you follow the cohort studies and if you go with case control studies, which are much more biased, I think the relative risk is 1.7. So there's a link, but of course, one is unmodifiable, and two, what do you do with the information? Well, take care of yourself. And it's also a small risk compared to other things, like smoking probably has a relative risk of 4. Diabetes is probably like 2 or 3, or obesity. So what you should do is if you have vertex baldness, in other words, it's not like front, it's like if you're going bald on the top, which affects like 30-40% of men in the country, so it's not like it's a uncommon risk factor, you should take care of yourself, not smoke, and eat healthy, and exercise. So it's one of those where we sort of know about it, but in the same way that being a man, you know, has a slightly higher risk of heart disease, or being one, but depending upon what it is, these are unmodifiable risk factors. If you know you have it, take care of yourself.
As another study says, it links baldness to handsomeness, and it says it's a direct connection.
Well, then you're safe.
I made up that study just now.
Well, now I made up the joke.
At Aaron E. Carroll is joining us. At Aaron E. Carroll on Twitter, and always blogging on the incidental Economist. Earlier, I guess I read that the Republican House is debating repealing parts of Obamacare today. At the same time, new signs are emerging that Obamacare is going to drive down insurance costs. We hear over and over from John Boehner and others that Obamacare is raising the cost of health insurance for Americans and premiums and so on. And then we've talked with you a lot about the correlation with whether or not they premiums would go up with or without Obamacare. And then we are also hearing a long conversation. This is first on that one.
The important thing to remember is that, you know, they talk about what will happen. And the problem is that they're both correct. The cost of insurance for a very healthy 28-year-old man who is single and has a phenomenal job and therefore won't get a subsidy, his insurance is likely going up next year because he was in an unbelievably awesome demographic, to buy incredibly cheap insurance, because insuring a 28-year-old man who will never get pregnant, who's perfectly healthy in the short term, who, you know, doesn't smoke, cheap. So his insurance is going up. But he does not represent the vast majority of people. And the vast majority of people will likely see their insurance on the individual market either go down, or at least they'll be able to now get a policy when they never could get one before. So I like to think of things at the societal level. That is what I do. That is how I discuss policy, or what will affect most Americans. And most Americans who are on the individual market and uninsured these days will find it easier to get insurance, and it will cost them less out of pocket to get a good comprehensive plan than they ever could before. But someone will likely wind up paying more than they did before. Then, of course, the news will feature probably the someones, as the bros, as they were called for a while. You know, that's, oh, look at how insurance is going up, and it's going to cost them way more money. But, of course, tons of people who were on, you know, markets before that either lacked a mandate or something, those are going to go down. I think the latest one was that New York is now projecting, you know, insurance rates are going to drop significantly. I think I even saw 50%, because they had a guaranteed issue community rating type market, but with no mandate. So they didn't have the healthy people in there now. Now that the law is going to force healthy people to buy insurance, the price of insurance is coming way down for most people who are trying to buy it, because the risk pool just got a lot healthier. But if you were one of those healthy people who could have gone to Texas and lived there and bought an incredibly cheap plan at the very young age, you can argue that now you're being forced to buy something that costs you more money than it did before. So it just depends on your perspective. But in general, overall, you know, most people, or the people who need insurance the most, are going to be able to get it at a much more comprehensive plan at a much more reasonable out-of-pocket rate than they ever
would. What do you think of the following statement, which is the subtitle of an article written by Matt Yglesias at Slate? He says, Obamacare skeptics are deluding themselves. Conservatives think the law is unraveling, but implementing the Affordable Care Act is going to be a huge success. How much do you agree with that?
I think people are being somewhat naive and ignoring history when they think that this is bad and that this is falling apart. Again, I even wrote a piece just like a couple weeks ago where we dredged up newspaper headlines and titles of articles and pieces of articles from after Medicaid was passed.
Oh, I totally missed that. That's a great idea.
It was even cited by Paul Krugman. So it was
fan.
Yep. So it was but you can look at what they were saying about Medicaid, and you could take those same statements and just move them into the common, you know, move them into today. You know, it's unwieldy. Doctors are going to quit in droves. It's falling apart. Look how it's being madly mishandled. It's a government takeover. All the things you hate today, you know, were said about Medicaid in the 1960s and 70s when that was put into play. And today, Medicaid is such a part of, you know, American society that threatening to remove it has been deemed by the Supreme Court to be coercive, or like putting a gun to states' heads. That's how bad people love their Medicaid now. So, you know, we've heard this before. And to think that, and you even think back to Ronald Reagan, who said that Medicare was the first step on like the road to serfdom or the road to tyranny, that it was the end of freedom. And is that what anyone is saying about Medicare anymore? You know, at some point you're crying wolf. And if you continue to say these kinds of things, when you recognize that not only do they work in America, but they work everywhere, it is somewhat delusional, because you're just ignoring history. You're ignoring how these things work. And it's also constantly just focusing on the negative and refusing to see the positive. You know, you can claim that, you know, Medicare is a huge government program, blah, 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 but everybody loves it. and everybody wants it. So you can feel free to go out and run against Medicare these days. You will lose your election, but go ahead. And it makes sense that someday people are going to view the Obamacare entitlement in the same way. And, you know, I've got insurance. I've got subsidies. I've got, you know, it covers my kid. I know that I'm sick and I'm never going to be denied insurance. I won't have job lock anymore. I can leave and go somewhere else, and I know I will be able to afford it. And then you're going to threaten to take it away someday? Good luck with that.
To me, by the way, that point about job lock, I didn't know there was a phrase for it. The idea that is, to me, such a real conservative value. I could argue it's a liberal value. I could argue it's an American value. I could argue it's a human value. The idea that you can pursue an opportunity, a dream, if you've got the means and the capital to do it, it is such a pro kind of freedom, and I don't use that word very loosely, but to have to be liberated to be able to say, you know what, I don't like this job, and I've got 50 grand or 100 grand put away to start my own business, but I cannot leave this job because starting my own business would be, even with that much money that I've responsibly made and put away, would be irresponsible because I can't then afford health care for me and my employees right away. I can't leave these great benefits and go, even though I save money and start my own business and follow my dreams, because I got a family that's depending on my health care. Being locked in your job lock, is such an anti-freedom idea. And we need to do everything we can to prevent that, to give people the choice, especially when the economy is so bad still, that, you know, there aren't choices. You can't say, I'm going to quit this job because the working conditions are bad, because there's not another job for most to get.
I agree. It also limits entrepreneurism. It limits, I have a chronic illness. My brother has a chronic illness. Like, we've talked multiple times about the fact, like, we both just always figure we have to work for large companies because that's the only way we were guaranteed to get health care. And someday my child might have a chronic illness, in which case, again, I can't leave because I have to be able to get them out. Now we will. They will be able to get health care. It will promote the ability to move. Again, remembering that, you know, the claim so many times that it's a job-killing bill because so many millions of people are going to leave the job force ignores the fact that the study was looking also at people who were like, now I can retire. I wanted to retire, but I couldn't retire because I would lose my insurance and not be able to buy it. Now I can. Or I wanted to leave my job and start a new business. I want to be an entrepreneur, but I can't because I can't get my job. And millions of people will likely leave the job market, like leave the employment force in the way that it stands now, because the Affordable Care Act, their jobs, they weren't fired. They had freedom. They could go. But you know, that gets twisted, of course, into it's a job-killing bill. This is where it gets somewhat frustrating in the sense that does seem very conservative. In fact, when McCain ran for president, he wanted, his plan was to completely decouple insurance from jobs, and instead of having like people who buy it through their jobs get this unfair tax break, just get rid of that entirely and give everybody in the United States a tax credit, the same tax credit.
Ironic. Socialism.
And he got destroyed for it. We should give him credit. He got destroyed for that.
Right. Dr. Carroll, at Aaron E. Carroll is the Twitter handle. 7,681. Did pretty good today. I would like to see better. Hopefully in the replay, we'll get some more Twitter. A really important, fascinating conversation we'll make available for you to share about the autism bullshit with Dr. Carroll. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you to my producers. Think for yourself. Look everything up. Be the change you want to see. Talk to you tomorrow.